At some length, and with much help from the constantly growing crowd, the matter was explained. I stood there wishing the floor would open and drop me down to the kitchen. I was hungry, having had nothing to eat since the night before. "Come with me," commanded the Lord Abbot. The senior lama took an arm and helped me, for I was tired, frightened, aching, and hungry. We went into a large room which I had not previously seen. The Lord Abbot seated himself and sat in silence as he thought of that which he had been told. "Tell me again, omitting nothing," he said to the lama. "So, once again I heard of my marvelous flight from the ground to the tomb of the Holy One. Just then my empty stomach gave a loud, warning rumble that it needed food." The Lord Abbot, trying not to smile, said, "Take him so that he may eat." I imagined that his ordeal has strained him. Then call the honorable herbalist Lama Chin to examine him for injuries. But let him eat first. Food. It tasted good. "You certainly have an up and down life, Lobsang," said the friendly cook monk. "First you get blown off the roof and thrown down the mountain. And now they tell me you have been blown from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the roof. An up and down life, and the devil looks after his own." Off he went, chuckling at his own wit. I did not mind, he was always kind to me and helped me in many little ways. Another friend greeted me, a rasping, roaring purr and a hearty butt against my legs made me look down. One of the cats had come to claim his share of my attention. Idly I let my fingers trail up and down his spine, making him purr louder and louder. A slight rustle from the direction of the barley sacks, and he was gone like a flash, silently. I moved to the window and peered out over Lhasa. No sign of the small party led by my guide the Lama Minya dawned up. Had he been caught by the storm? I wondered. Wondered too, how much longer he would be returning. Tomorrow, then, eh? I turned. One of the kitchen hangers on had been saying something and I had caught only the end. "Yes," said another, "they are staying at the Rose Fence tonight and returning tomorrow." "Oh," I said. "Are you talking about my guide?" The Lama Minya donned up. "Yes. It seems that we shall have to put up with you for yet another day, Lobsang," said one of the hangers-on. "But that reminds me, the Honorable Infirmarian is waiting for you, you'd better hurry." I slouched gloomily off thinking that there were too many troubles in the world. Why should my guide have to stop on his journey and stay perhaps a day and a night at the Rose Fence Lamasery? At that stage of my existence I thought that only my affairs were of importance, and I did not fully realize the great work that the Lama Minya Don Up was doing for others. I slouched along the corridor to the infirmarian's office. He was just coming out, but as he saw me he grabbed my arm and led me back. "Now what have you been doing? There is always some incident or item whenever you come to the Potala." I moodily stood before him and told him only that which eyewitnesses had seen about the wind and about the great storm. I did not tell him that I was already on the golden roof for, as I knew, his first thought would be to report to the inmost one. "Well, take off your robe, I have to examine you for injuries and then I have to give a report on your condition." I shrugged off my robe and threw it on a low bench. The infirmarian knelt and probed and prodded to see if I had any bones broken or muscles torn. He was rather surprised that my only injuries, apart from my damaged legs, were that I was covered with blue-black bruises, some with yellow overtones. "Here, take this, and rub it well into yourself," he said, standing up and reaching to a high shelf, and bringing down a leather jar full of some herb ointment which had a most powerful stink. "Do not rub it on here," he said. "I do not want to be gassed out." "They are your bruises after all, Honorable Infirmarian," I said. "Is it true that my guide is having to stop at the Rose Fence Lamasery?" "Yes. He is having to treat an abbot there, and I do not expect that he will be returning here until late tomorrow. So we have to put up with you a while longer," he said, and then added slyly, "You will be able to enjoy the lectures by our respected Indian teacher visitor." I looked at him and the thought occurred to me that the old infirmarian had no greater love for the Indian teacher than I had. However, there was no time now to deal with that. The sun was directly overhead, and it was time I was going to our lecture hall again. First I went to the dormitory where I stripped off my robe and rubbed in the stinking ointment. Then I wiped my hands on my robe, put it on again, and made my way back to the lecture hall, taking my place at the back as far away from the Indian teacher as I could. The other boys came in, small boys, medium-sized boys, and big boys, all crammed in together because this was a special event, a visit by a very noted Indian teacher, and it was thought that we boys would profit by hearing Buddhism as taught by another culture. As we sat waiting for the teacher, boys were audibly sniffing. The ones near to me moved away, so by the time the teacher arrived I was sitting in solitary splendor against the wall, with a semicircle of boys not closer than about 12 feet. The Indian teacher came in carrying his delightful little leather bag, but sniffing, looking about him suspiciously. His nostrils were working and he was sniffing very audibly. Halfway between the door and the lectern he stopped and looked about, then he saw that I was sitting alone. He came towards me but soon retreated. The room was quite warm with so many boys in it, and with warmth the ointment was becoming more and more pungent. The Indian teacher stopped, put his hands on his hips, and he glared at me. "My boy, you are the biggest troublemaker in this whole country, I believe. You upset our beliefs by flying up and down the mountainside. I saw it all from my own room. I saw you going up in the distance. You must have devils teach you in your odd moments, or something. And now, off!" exclamation mark, "you stink." "Honorable Indian teacher," I replied, "I cannot help the stench. I am merely using ointment prescribed by the Honorable Infirmarian, and," I added, greatly daring, "it is much the worse for me because the stuff is fairly bubbling out of me." Not a flicker of a smile crossed his lips, he just turned contemptuously aside and moved away to the lectern. "We must get on with our lectures," said the Indian teacher, "for I shall be very glad to leave you and to journey onwards to more cultured India." He arranged his papers, shuffled around a bit, looked suspiciously at all of us to see if we were paying attention, then he continued. Gautama in his wanderings had thought a lot. For 6 years he had wandered, spending most of his time searching for truth, seeking for truth, seeking the purpose behind life. As he wandered he suffered hardships, suffered privation, hunger, and one of his first questions was, "Why am I unhappy?" Gautama pondered the question incessantly, and the answer came to him when the creatures of nature were assisting him, the snails cooling his head, the birds fanning his brow, and all the others keeping quiet that he should not be disturbed. He decided that there were 4 great truths, which he called the 4 noble truths, which were the laws of man's stay on earth. "Birth is suffering," said the Buddha. "A baby is born to its mother, causing pain to the mother and pain to the baby. Only through pain can one be born to this earth, and the act of being born causes pain and suffering to others. Decay is suffering, as a man gets older and his body's cells are not able to replenish along the familiar pattern. Decay sets in, organs no longer function correctly, change takes place, and there is suffering. One cannot grow old without suffering. Illness is suffering, with the failure of an organ to operate correctly there is pain, suffering, as the organ compels the body to readjust to the new condition. Wherefore it is that illness causes pain and suffering. Death is the end of illness. Death causes suffering, not the act of dying itself, but the conditions which bring about death are in themselves painful. Therefore, again, we are unhappy. Suffering is caused by the presence of objects which we hate. We are kept in tension, in frustration, by the presence of those we dislike. We are made unhappy by the separation from objects we love, when we are parted from a dear one, perhaps with no knowledge of when we are going to be with that person again. Then we suffer pain, we suffer frustration, wherefore we are unhappy. To desire, and not to obtain that which we desire, that is the cause of suffering, that is the cause of loss of happiness, the cause of misery. Wherefore it is that as we desire and do not obtain, then instead we suffer and are unhappy. Death only brings peace. Death only brings release from suffering. Wherefore it is clear that clinging to existence is clinging to suffering, Clinging to existence is that which makes us unhappy. The Indian teacher looked at us, and said, "The Buddha, I blessed Gautama, was not pessimistic but realistic. Gautama realized that until one can accept facts one cannot banish suffering. Until one can understand why there is suffering one cannot progress along the middle way." The teachings stressed a lot about suffering, I thought, but I remembered what my own dear guide, the Lama Minyadon Up, had said to me. He said, "Let us, Lobsang, consider what Gautama really did say. He did not say that everything causes suffering. No matter what the scriptures say, no matter what the great teachers say, Gautama at no time stated that everything is suffering. He really said that everything holds the possibility of suffering, from which it is clear that every incident of life can result in pain or discomfort or disharmony. It is nowhere stated that everything must cause pain. There is so much misunderstanding about what great men did or did not say." Gautama had the belief that suffering, pain, went far beyond mere physical suffering, mere physical pain. He emphasized at all times that the sufferings of the mind through the dysfunction of the emotions was a greater suffering, a greater disharmony, than any mere physical pain or unhappiness could cause. Gautama taught, "If I am unhappy, it is because I am not living happily, because I am not living in harmony with nature. If I am not living harmoniously, it is because I have not learned to accept the world as it is, with all its disadvantages and possibilities of suffering. I can only attain happiness by realizing the causes of unhappiness and avoiding those causes." I was busy thinking of this, and thinking of what an awful stink that ointment was causing, when the Indian teacher slapped his lectern again, and said, "This is the first of the noble truths. Now let us deal with the second of the noble truths." Gautama gave his sermon to his disciples, those who had previously left him when much of the sensation had gone from the teaching, but now they were Gautama's disciples again. He said to them, "I teach only two things, suffering and release from suffering. Now this the noble truth as to the origin of suffering. It is the craving thirst that causes the renewal of becomings. The craving thirst is accompanied by sensual delights and seeks satisfaction now here, now there. It takes the form of craving for the gratification of the senses, or the craving for prosperity and worldly possessions. As we were taught, suffering follows something which we have done wrongly. It is the result of a wrong attitude towards the rest of the world. The world itself is not a bad place, but some of the people in it make it appear bad, and it is our own attitude, our own faults, which make the world seem so bad. Everyone has desires, or cravings, or lusts, which make one do things which in a more balanced mood, when free from such cravings and lusts, one would not do. The great teaching of the Buddha was that he who craves cannot be free, and a person who is not free cannot be happy. Therefore, to overcome craving is to take a big step forward towards happiness. Gautama taught that every person has to find happiness for himself. He said that there is a happiness that does not give contentment, it is merely a transient thing and is the type of happiness which a person obtains when he or she wants change, always, always want to flit around seeing fresh sights, meeting fresh people. That is transient happiness. The true happiness is that which gives one deep contentment, gives one's soul release from dissatisfaction. Gautama said, "When in following after happiness, I have perceived that bad qualities develop, and good qualities were diminished, then that kind of happiness is to be avoided. When following after happiness I have perceived that bad qualities were diminished and good qualities developed, such happiness is to be followed. We, then, have to stop chasing about after the idle things of the flesh, the things which do not endure into the next world. We have to stop trying to satisfy cravings which grow the more we feed them, and, instead, we have to think, what are we really looking for, how shall we find it? We have to think of the nature of our cravings, the cause of our cravings, and having known the cause of our cravings, then we can seek to remove that cause." Our teacher was warming up to his subject. He was being a little troubled, too, by the smell of herb ointment, for he said, "We will have a recess for the moment because I do not want to overstrain your mentality, which, I perceive, is not at all the mentality of my Indian students." He picked up his papers, put them in his case, carefully snapped the lock, and held his breath as he walked by me. For a few moments the other boys sat still waiting for his footsteps to die away in the distance. Then one turned to me and said, "Boo. Lobsang, you do stink. It must be because you have been mixing with devils, flying up and down to heaven with them." I replied quite reasonably, "Well, if I have been mixing with devils I should not be flying to heaven with them, but the other way, and as everyone knows I flew up." We dispersed and went our way. I went to the window and looked out pensively, wondering what my guide was doing at the Rose Fence Lamasery, wondering how I should fill in the time with this Indian teacher whom I thoroughly disliked. I thought that if he was such a good Buddhist as he imagined himself to be, then he would have more understanding and feeling for small boys. As I was standing there thinking, a young lama came into the room in a hurry. "Lobsang," he said, "come quickly, the inmost one will see you." Then he stopped and said, "Boo. Whatever have you done?" So I told him about the herb ointment, and he said, "Let us hurry to the infirmary to see what can be done to get rid of that stench before you see the inmost one. Come, quickly." Chapter 5. Together we rushed down the corridor towards the infirmarian's office. Together? No, not quite. The young lama did the rushing, I followed on faltering legs. Followed because he had a grip on the front of my robe and was towing me. I muttered and grumbled to myself as much as lack of breath would permit. I get blown off the ground and onto the roof, and now everyone pushes me around. Ow! I thought, now I am almost believing that I was blown up. Ow! I wondered what the inmost one thought, or knew. We skittered around the corner and swept into the office. The infirmarian was having tsampa. At sight of us he paused and looked up. His mouth dropped open at seeing me again and his hand hovered between bowl and mouth. "You again? You? What have you done this time?" The young lama, gasping with excitement, anxiety, and lack of breath, poured out a stumbling cascade of words, almost dripping over his own tongue with the speed of his speech. "The inmost one, he wants to see Lobsang now. What can we do?" The infirmarian sighed as he put down his bowl and wiped his fingers on his robe. "He will not merely see him, but smell him if I take him like this," the young lama muttered agitatedly. I, what can we do to sweeten him?" The infirmarian chuckled and then speedily became solemn as he thought of the inmost one. "Ah," he said, "I only did it for a joke. I was trying a new ointment and he was available. It is also an ointment which can be spread on posts and walls to keep dogs off by its smell, but it is a bruise ointment. Now, let me think." The young lama and I looked at each other in some dismay. Dog repellent, well, it had certainly made me repellent. But what to do now? So the old man had played a joke on me, had he? Well, I thought, now the joke was on him. How was he going to get rid of the smell before the Dalai Lama knew about it? He jumped to his feet and snapped his fingers with satisfaction. "Off with your robe," he commanded. I shrugged out of my robe again. The infirmarian went into the side room, to emerge minutes later with a leather pail filled with sweet-smelling liquid. Pushing me over a small drain in his office, he upended the pail and poured the contents over my head. I hopped and hopped. The stuff was astringent, and I thought my skin would peel off. Quickly grasping a rag, he swabbed my body, leaving it very pink, very smarting, but sweet-smelling. "There," he exclaimed with satisfaction. "You have been a great trouble to me. Perhaps a painful treatment will discourage you from coming except in dire necessity." He went back into the other room and returned bearing a clean robe. "Put it on," he commanded. "We cannot have you going to the inmost one looking like a scarecrow." I dressed, itching and tingling all over. The rough material of the robe made matters worse, but the young lama and the infirmarian did not seem to mind that. "Quick! Quick!" said the former. "We must not waste time." He grabbed my arm and dragged me towards the door. I moved reluctantly, leaving scented wet footmarks on the floor. "Wait!" cried the infirmarian. "He must have sandals." With a flurry, He disappeared and then came into view carrying a pair of sandals. I thrust my feet into them and found they were large enough for a person twice my size. "Ow!" I exclaimed in panic. "They are too big, I shall trip over them or lose them. I want mine." "Oh! Aren't you a one?" snapped the infirmarian. "Just a bundle of trouble, always in trouble. Wait. I must get you fitted right, or you will fall over in the presence of the inmost one and so disgrace me." He bumbled around, fiddling and fumbling, and then produced a pair of sandals which were of more satisfactory fitting. "Go!" he exclaimed. "Don't come back here unless you are dying." He turned crossly away and continued his interrupted meal. The young lama was panting with worry and excitement. "How shall I explain the delay?" he asked, as if I could give him the answer. We hurried along the corridor and soon were overtaken by another young lama. "Where have you been?" he asked in some exasperation. "The inmost one is waiting, and he does not like to be kept waiting." This was no time for explanations. We hurried along the corridors, climbing to the floor above, and the floor above that, and yet another floor. At last we reached a large doorway guarded by two immense proctors. Recognizing the two young lamas, they moved aside, and we entered the private quarters of the Dalai Lama. Suddenly the first young lama skidded to a halt and pushed me against the wall. "Keep still," he said. "I must see that you are tidy." He looked me up and down, pulling a fold here, draping a fold there. "Turn around," he commanded, as he eyed me carefully, hoping that I was no more untidy than the average small acolyte. I turned around, with my face to the wall. Again he pulled and tugged and straightened my robe. "You are the boy with the injured legs. Well, the inmost one knows of it. If he tells you to sit, sit as gracefully as you can." "All right, turn round." I turned, noticing that the other young lama had gone. We stood and waited. We waited until I thought my knees would give out. "All that rush, and now we wait," I thought. "Why do I have to be a monk?" The inner door opened and an elderly lama came out. The young lama bowed, and withdrew. The high official, for that is who the elderly lama was, looked at me, looked me up and down and asked, "Can you walk without assistance?" "Holy master," I replied, "I can with difficulty walk." "Then come," he said, turning and slowly leading the way into another room, crossing it, and coming to a corridor. At a door, he knocked and entered, motioning for me to wait outside. "Your Holiness," I heard his respectful voice say. "The boy Lobsang. He does not walk well. The infirmarian says that he is badly bruised and his legs are not yet healed." I could not hear the reply, but the elderly lama came out and whispered, "Go in, while standing, bow three times and then advance when so instructed. Walk slowly, do not fall, now." He gently took my arm and led me through the door, saying, "Your Holiness, the boy Lobsang," before leaving and closing the door behind me. Blinded by emotion and fright, I hesitantly bowed three times in what I hoped was the right direction. "Come, my boy, come and sit here," said a deep, warm voice, a voice I had heard once before during a previous visit. I looked up and saw first the saffron robe glowing softly in a bright shaft of sunlight which streamed through the window. The saffron robe. Above it, a kind but firm face, the face of one who was used to making decisions. The face of a good man, our God upon earth. He was sitting on a small platform raised from the ground. The red cushions upon which he rested contrasted with the saffron of his robe. He was in the lotus position, with his hands clasped in front of him and his knees and feet were covered with a gold cloth. In front of him there was a low table containing just a few articles, a small bell, a charm box, a prayer wheel, and state papers. He had a mustache then, and its ends depended slightly below his chin. His face bore a benign smile, but marks of suffering were there too. Before him, to the side of the small table, two seat cushions were upon the floor. To these he motioned, saying, "I know of your disability, sit in any way comfortable." Gratefully I sat down, for all the rushing around, all the excitement, All these were having their effect upon me, and I was trembling slightly with weariness. "So," said His Holiness, "you have had some adventures? I have heard much about it. It must have been very frightening." I looked at him, at this great man so full of goodness and knowledge. Now, I knew, I would have to tell him what happened, for I would not deceive him. "All right, then I would be expelled, cast out, driven forth for breaking the law and climbing too high. Never mind, I would be a boatman or a builder of kites," or, my mind boggled at the thought, "I might even travel to India and become a trader." The inmost one was looking hard at me, and I jumped in some confusion as I realized he had been speaking to me. "Your Holiness," I said, "my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, has told me you are the greatest man in the world, and I cannot conceal the truth from you." I paused and swallowed a lump that had come into my throat. "Your Holiness," I said in a faint voice, "I arose early this morning and climbed." "Lobsang," said the inmost one, his face glowing with pleasure. "Say no more, tell me no more, I already know it, having been a small boy myself, oh, so very long ago." He paused and looked thoughtfully at me. "This I enjoin upon you," he said. "You are not at any time to discuss this with another. You are to remain silent upon the matter of what really did happen. Otherwise you will be expelled as the law demands." For a moment he was deep in thought, then he added, musingly, "It is good, sometimes, to have a miracle, for it strengthens the faith of the lower and weaker brothers. They need what they imagine is proof, but proof examined closely often proves to be but illusion, whereas the illusion for which proof was sought is truly the reality." The mid-morning sun was flooding the room with golden light. The saffron robe of the inmost one glowed and seemed to be half flame as a whisper of wind dared to rustle its folds. The red cushions had a halo and cast ruddy reflections on the polished floor. A small prayer wheel stirred gently to the vagrant breeze, and its turquoise insets flashed little blue beams on the golden air. Almost tidily, the inmost one stretched out his hand and picked up the prayer wheel, looked at it speculatively, and put it down again. "Your guide, my brother in holiness, Minya Dondup, speaks very, very highly of you," said His Holiness. "And so do those who know you well. You have a great task in life, and you will be more and more in the care of your guide and of men like him, so you will be withdrawn more and more from class studies and will have private tuition of a much higher standard." The inmost one paused and looked at me with a smile lurking at the corners of his eyes. "But you will have to continue that course of lectures with our Indian visitor," he said. That shook me. I was hoping to avoid that awful man, hoping to get out of attending the afternoon lecture on the strength of my great experience. The inmost one continued, "Your guide will return late tonight or early tomorrow morning. He will report to me, then you will return with him to Iron Mountain to continue specialized studies. The wise men have determined your future. It will be hard always, but the more you study now the better will be your chances later." He nodded kindly to me, and reached out for his little bell. With a musical sound it rang out, summoning the Elder Lama, who came hurrying in. I rose to my feet with some difficulty, bowed three times with disgraceful awkwardness, clutching my breast, so that my bowl and other items should not fall out as previously, and withdrew backwards, almost praying that I should not trip and fall over. Outside, mopping the perspiration from my brow and steadying myself against the wall, I wondered, what next? The Elder Lama smiled upon me, for I had been blessed by the inmost one, and said kindly, "Well, now, boy." "That was a very long interview for so small a boy. His Holiness seemed pleased with you." Now he looked out at the shadows. "Now it is time for you to eat and go to your class for the Indian Buddhism lecture." "All right, my boy, you may go. This official will see you past the guards." He smiled at me again and turned aside. The young Lama whom I had first met appeared around a screen and said, "Come on, this way." I followed, almost tottering, thinking that this day, which was not even half over, seemed a week long already. So once again I made my way to the kitchen and begged some tsampa. This time I was treated with respect, for I had been in the presence of the Inmost One and already reports had flown that he had been pleased with me. With my meal hastily eaten, and still smelling sweetly, I repaired to the classroom.